basically do more of a chronological date story, so that tomorrow I'll just pick up and continue chronologically from 1952, 56, 58, 62, so on like that. Although I may jump around a little bit because some stories intertwine from one year to the other. So we'll see what happens. So feel free to raise your hand or just speak out if you have like a "but then what happened" or any kind of a question, you know, or if something occurs to you, go right ahead. So since I'm the daughter of Jean and Darwin Shaw, I have a brother, an older brother, and a younger sister. So we all grew up in a Baba family because my parents met Baba in 1934. We had a Christian background. We went to Christian churches as children. My parents had Baba meetings in their homes and sang the old hymns around the organ because there weren't any Baba songs. We kids were sent to bed, so we never sat in on the meetings. And I think for me it made me more eager to know what was going on. And we were attracted to by the songs, the quality of the feeling with the songs. I was attracted to Baba by the pictures in the house as a child. I didn't know that I loved Baba, but I accepted Baba as God even as a small child, and soon learned that you don't tell your playmates that because it runs into trouble. And so anyway, my father would be going down to New York from time to time to introduce Narina for talks. And one time they took us along, and Narina, we as usual had to sit outside the hall and hear what was going on. Children were seen and not heard. Narina had a private interview with us, and she just was she was my first contact with Baba outside of my immediate family.
Can you explain who Narina was?
Right. Narina Princess Narina Machiavelli was one of Baba's close disciples from the 30s on. And she gave lectures in New York in the 40s. And she was a magnificent woman. She was able to project Baba's love tremendously. And she was very theatrical and flamboyant and just very, very loving. So we had this little interview with her, and it was at that time when I felt Baba's love. And it was just a little wee drop of love, actually. But then it was then that I made the decision consciously that this is what I wanted from life, that my life would be dedicated to the pursuit of this love and to Baba. Still, I didn't know I loved Baba. We lived in Myrtle Beach for a while, 1949, and Narina and Elizabeth came back from India, and we were all in Yupan Dunes, the house they were living in. We were there together for a month. And I guess I was kind of a favorite of Narina's. She passed me in the living room or in the kitchen and chucked me under the chin or pat me, and I just felt Baba's love from her. And still, we didn't have any nice long chats with her. She'd be talking to my parents, or they'd go for walks, and I really felt kind of left out. But anyway, it increased my interest and my longing. I started reading the discourses when I was 14 at Yupan Dunes. I'd be dusting the living room, and I'd find the discourses and sit down and read for a while. And I at that point could understand some of it, but not very much. And I thought, well, there must be more than one way to go about this, maybe through the heart, and maybe I'll have to do that too. And so I used to sit there looking out the window looking out over the ocean, wondering, why did God create the creation, and what am I here for, and things like that. So I was really on my own personal inner search for God and for the truth and for the answers. In fact, it occupied a lot of my time. I wasn't into the usual teenage things because I was more interested in my inner pursuits, my secret life. So then in 1950, well, actually before 1952, Dr. Duncan came to the United States, and he was my second Baba link. And I again felt Baba's love through Dr. Duncan. Another confirmation that that's what I really wanted. Also during my growing up years, my parents never sat us down and say, this is what it's all about. We just naturally would ask questions from time to time. I remember when I was 9 and 10, I went through reincarnation pretty thoroughly, asking every question I could think of. My sister and I particularly went through that. So we had some things sort of under our belt by 1952. But basically, when it came time to meet Baba, I didn't know very much about Baba. I didn't know anything about, by comparison with what you know about Baba, I didn't know very much, really. I had heard my parents talk about their meeting Baba and how it affected them. And of course, I could see how it affected them in leading their lives and how they treated us and all of that. And we three wanted to meet Baba very, very much. And we received some letters from Baba in the 40s and promises that we would see him soon. And they were precious and still are. So when the big day came, May 10th, 1952, we drove down to Myrtle Beach. We had our family appointment. I had anxiety and fear that I wouldn't measure up. I wouldn't feel Baba's love and all kinds of unknown things. And so when we went to the center. Of course, we were used to the center. We spent 1949 there at Yukon Dunes, and we went to the center often, and it was really a home. I felt very, very much at home at the center. And we worked around at the center a bit, cleaning up and doing different things. So anyway, we approached the lagoon cabin, our Shaw family of five, and I ducked behind my mother so she could be first. And we entered the door. Baba was standing, and he embraced my mother. And then he embraced me. And I felt, at last I've come home. And all the fears, everything vanished. I was wrapped in his embrace, and I was home free. And then I stood aside, and my sister and brother and father embraced Baba, and Baba was the gracious host, and he had us sit down, and he said, had us sit over here, and Adi was interpreting. And my sister and I were choking down the tears, and Baba was very, very happy looking. He was radiant and very relaxed and very natural. And he said, I am very happy. He said, God in heaven is happy that you have come. You know, so you could make God happy that you have come. And he said, he pointed to Renee and me, and he said, they haven't seen me before, because my brother had seen Baba in April. And we nodded, you know, that we hadn't seen Baba before. And then he said, they love me. You know, and we're going, And the odd thing about meeting Baba is that here he is, God in human form, which is terribly awesome. And if you let that thought, if you dwell on that thought, you can be scared stiff, you know. But Baba puts one at such ease because he acts so natural, like your closest friend, and just makes you feel very much at ease. And at the same time, I felt I was trying to grasp the significance of all this. At the same time, I was looking at him, observing his physical form, feeling the radiance of his love and his light and his bliss, listening to Adi. I hardly noticed Adi interpreting. You just heard the voice because you really didn't miss Baba's silence. And our hearts being overwhelmed with his love. And here I was, taking notes in shorthand. And it was very difficult to concentrate on shorthand. We lost track of time entirely. So I don't know how long the interview went. Baba said to my parents, "How do I look?" You know, because they hadn't seen him since 1934. And they said, "Beautiful, Baba. Have I changed?" "Not too much." And he sort of smiled. And so we had kind of chit-chat at first, just to put us at ease. But so much was happening within our hearts through this. Our minds couldn't handle any deeper subject. anything more would have blown us away. It's just too much to grasp him. His eyes are large and luminous, and they flash, they move about very quickly, and his smile is just from ear to ear, and it doesn't stop smiling. There's a lightness about him, about his presence. Lightness in softness, like rose petals or gardenia petals. There's a fragrance about him, a sweet fragrance. He wasn't very tall, but at times he changed his height. He's at that time he was around my height, maybe give or take a little bit. And when embracing him, In one sense, you felt like you could, go all the way through him. He was so light. And in another sense, he had a very firm body, a strong body. It's kind of two opposites in one. And when embracing him to say goodbye, I was just choked up. I couldn't say anything. All I could say in my heart was, "I love you, I love you." I was 18. And so our interview, first interview, passed all too quickly. We were wiping our tears and all that. I don't know whether it was during the first interview or at some time later that I could assess it to some extent. And that is, I felt that when you, first meeting Baba, he looks at you like you're to me. He looked at me like, and I don't mean just me, I think he does it to everyone. He looks at you like you're the dearest person in the world, that you're so precious to him. And he gives you the kind of love that no one else can love you like that. The kind of love that's unconditional. And I saw that he could see everything about me, including anything that maybe I wouldn't want anyone to see. And so knowing that he knows all, he loved me anyway. And I knew that nothing could change his love for me. He wraps you in a security blanket of his love, because that's what we all want, is to be loved in such a way that it will never change. So it was really the perfect love. Also, when he looked into my eyes, I saw that he was seeing himself in me. And it's kind of startling to think about that, because that means that he is in me. And that means I have to say, well, yes, he is in me. And that's kind of a surprise. I mean, there's no denying it once you see that he sees himself in you. You see what I mean? And so you have to accept that he is in you. And his happiness in seeing you and loving you is because he is conscious of himself in us all the time. And he's happy because we're beginning to be conscious of him in us. And that's what he came to do. And so his happiness makes us happy too. In the West, the word identity and identity crisis comes up from time to time. And I feel that this is how Baba gives us our identity continually as we come closer and closer to him. The more we find him, and the more we find him within us, the more we change our conception of our identity. And that's kind of interesting. Maybe I'll say more about that later. But I'll move along. Or maybe I'll say that now. I don't know when to say it. It's like that was my first awareness. Hi. Now I can say what I was debating to say. Lisa and I were in India in July. I was just saying that Baba gives us an identity. And this is something that I found out when I first met Baba. And that identity changes. And now I'm supposed to be this grown-up person. And inside I don't always feel that way, because my identity is somewhere else. And sometimes people say, well, you met Baba such and such and such in time, and all these years have passed, and you've gone to India a number of times. Now what is it like? And what's happened? And in 1984, I went to India, and while I was there, I knew what was happening from moment to moment, how I was conscious of what was happening within me. And this time in India, I couldn't become conscious of what was happening within me until I got back home. And I'm still becoming conscious of what was happening. And what happened was that I found out I'm nothing. That's where it all leads to. So that's our true identity. So I've lost a lot. I mean, I went to India to lose. That's what happened. I mean, I'm more conscious of the fact that I'm really nothing. One becomes more conscious that one's entire being amounts to zero, because Baba's responsible for everything. And you see, as we grow in years in our physical life, we take on characteristics of the world, and we call ourselves grown up, and we come into a position of feeling secure, and we have a certain strength and power, And you see a lot of people throwing it around because they become aware that they have it and they can do something with it and they have some authority and some influence. And I'm finding out that the more you feel that something like that is there, the more you need to know that it isn't yours, that it is Baba's, that the source is Baba. So that's something that's happened with me. So I'll go on with back to 1952. We had two interviews in the Lagoon Cabin in 1952. And we were staying in an apartment in town, and many people had appointments with Baba, and my parents and we would go over to the Lafayette Hotel and greet them because their appointments were on the following day, and somebody kind of had to act as impromptu host and hostesses. And my sister and I would sit there and watch everything, and we'd say, "I know who's met Baba and who hasn't." And then we check it out, and you could tell their eyes, they were different. Their eyes were so full of light and they were so full of love. It was an immediate transformation. Also, when we were back at the apartment, we were doing, you know, some light housekeeping, and I was sweeping the floor, and I suddenly realized, hey, I'm thinking about all kinds of things that I usually think about, and I'm not thinking about Baba. Here I've just met Baba, and I'm not thinking about him. Something must be wrong with me. And, you know, in one sense I was overwhelmed with Baba, but on the other sense, here I was, back to the usual. I thought, what's the point of meeting Baba if it's back to the usual? I was letting my mind just do its usual runaround. And I said, no way, no more. I'm in charge. My mind is dethroned. No more deifying the mind. It's not where it's at. I choose to do what I want to do with my mind instead of the other way around. And that was the first time I became aware that I had something to say about what my mind does, and that the mind does present a problem to us. It's a conditioned mind, and it's constantly at us and after us to preserve itself, the ego mind. And that was the first time in my life I told it to shut up. And I became also aware that there's... you see, we're so accustomed to accepting the verdicts of the mind for anything that happens in our lives, that it sits in judgment for us. And when I met Baba, I found out that there's something higher in me and more sure and more true as the measuring stick than my mind, and that I can rely on and is more faithful to me than my mind. And so that's always stuck by me. Anytime my mind gets the best of me, I go back to that. Now, on the second interview, we were greeted by Baba again, warmly and affectionately and lovingly, and we sat down on the couch, and we had our chit-chat, and there were quite a number of things Baba said to us. But the most important thing Baba said to Renee and me was, he turned to us and he said, just out of the blue, nonchalantly, like it's a nice day out, he says, will you do anything I ask you to do? And I go, yes, Baba. And he says, is that yes or just yes? And I was thinking, on the first yes, I was thinking, well, yes, and sometime later I'll think about whether I can do it. And so when he said yes or just yes, I confirmed firmly. It was an act of bold decision. That's why he asked it again. To give us the chance to assert that yes, we would do anything he asked us to do. Then he said, would you jump in the lake? I said, yes, Baba, knowing I can swim. With the alligators? Yes, Baba. Even if I were to die in the jaws of an alligator, with Baba's love around you, wrapped around you, it's not hard to say that. And to make that kind of a commitment to him, to obey him. And he said, I am in the snakes, I am in the deer, I am in the alligator, I am in everything. And if you knew that, you would not be afraid of anything, and nothing would upset you. And I'm still working on that. It's a very profound thing. And the thing that strikes me is right off the very first thing Baba gets to, the real business is to get us to commit ourselves to obey him, no matter what. And then he said, I'm very happy that you will obey me without hesitation. And he said, isn't that right, Darwin? They will obey me without hesitation. He repeated it several times. We couldn't figure out why, but as some of us were saying, sometimes when Baba says something like that, he's affirming that it is so and that he will make it so. And I think that's why he kept repeating it. And it also makes a strong impression on the mind. Another thing is the commitment to obey Baba, in my opinion, strikes the death knell of the ego. Because you must let go. When you obey Baba, you must surrender. There's a lot to it. It's not a small thing. And also he says himself, there's a series of sentences that I can't quote, but it ends up, obeying me leads to my grace, which leads to my love. So it's critical. In fact, here's a quote. When people come to a perfect master and touch his feet with their hands, they lay the burden of their samskaras on him. He collects the samskaras from all over the universe, just as an ordinary person in walking collects dust on his feet. The custom of the aspirant to have darshan and fall at his feet is, and they wash his feet with milk and honey and place a coconut near his feet as an offering. This symbolizes the throwing of the burden of all samskaras on the master and surrendering the mind to him. And to go along with this, a quote from the Discourse says, the adoption of this inner attitude constitutes the most critical and important step which the aspirant has to take for getting initiated into the path. So that's how that's put together. I mean, I didn't know that then. It was a very spontaneous obedience and willingness and happiness to obey him. In 1958, Wendy, you probably remember at the barn, he asked how many would obey him. And all raised his hands and he said, I'm happy. You've all agreed and are willing to obey me. And he said, now I can go home. Because that was why he came. And it's not that he needs anything for himself. It's for us. It opens the channel through which his love grace can flow to us. And it's our opportunity to let go of all of our burdens. They aren't our burdens in the first place. They're all his. I mean, if he's in everyone and everything, how could they be ours? Well, that's another subject. So then, also, on this first meeting, when we had our parting embrace with Baba, each of us, he held me in the embrace for just probably a moment, and I don't think anybody noticed, but that moment was timeless, a timeless eternity in him, because he held my face in such a way so that I could look into his eyes. And normally when you look into most people's eyes, there's kind of a stopping point and you have nice contact with that person. Well, at the beginning of this chance to look into his eyes, I knew that something different was about to happen and that I had to make a very quick decision whether I was going to be frightened and look away or seize upon this opportunity he was giving me to look into his eyes, because somehow I knew that in looking into his eyes at this moment and what he was about to let me do, I would have to leave all of my self and all of my security, all that I knew that was secure, all the things we all hang on to that we call security, I had to let go in order to look into his eyes and venture out into the unknown, leave everything behind. It was like forever that I would never come back to any of that again. And I was going out on this journey out to sea and never to see land again. And in an instant, I made the decision. I looked into his eyes, and I kept on going endlessly into his eyes. And what I saw was formless light, formless, colorless light, brilliant light. And time stood still, everything stood still. I was in the stillness of his being somewhere. And then quick as a flash, back to normal consciousness, everything the same as usual, nobody noticed a thing, and nothing unusual about this, on with it, and on to the next person, and I didn't think it was unusual at all. I just thought it was wonderful. He doesn't make much of these things that really are kind of wonderful. And he gives to each person what's really special to them. How could anyone have any question of whether he was God or not after that? But it didn't occur to me then to even make that kind of a question. We just kind of floated out. And in our family, we, while we were with Baba, we were sharing these deep, beautiful, precious moments. And it's when you share something so intimately, you almost know what's happening with the other person. But then again, you don't know. My parents, in fact, no one knew for quite a few years what really happened. And the same with each of us. But the rapport we had of love was where we were focused. So our individual reactions were not discussed. It sounds strange, but we would talk about Bob and how it was being with him, but we didn't talk about the deeper inner experience like that. But we knew that there was an inner drama going on with each individual that was precious to them, their own inner experience. And we didn't intrude on each other. It was enough, because there was so much to grasp in Baba. We would say, how can we assimilate this? How can we fathom this? And then we'd go around saying, from year to year, 52, 56, 58, how come it's us? How come we're with Baba? I mean, there's so many other people who are far more deserving. And they said, well, I don't know, but we're going to make the best of it. And Baba said, it is up to you to draw out from the ocean as much as you can. Make the most of this opportunity. And while everything was lighthearted and smiling and bright and happy, those words were serious, and I took them very seriously. And I found myself working furiously within to empty myself so that I could contain more of, and draw more from Baba. So it was a very, very fast activity within. It's an activity of reversing the currents. We generally go around life with currents that take in everything. We acquire sand scares. We acquire our impressions of everything. We're always doing this. And for the first time, I was going like that, out, away from myself. I mean, it's one thing to receive Baba's love, but you reach a filled-up point where you can't receive anything more until you start getting rid of something and make more room. And Baba said, give everything to me. And everything means everything, all the way to surrender. So it's explained different types of surrenders. And when we're with Baba, we experience the surrender through love, the surrender where we're not conscious of surrendering. It's just in our anxiousness to receive more of Baba's love, I found I had to just get rid of things, get rid of everything without looking at it. Just quickly get rid of everything. And that sets up an energy. And while I'm talking about energy, being with Baba creates a great longing to be near him, to be closer to him, and to experience his love continuously. Because somehow you feel that's the way it should be. And this longing can reach, it's something to be encouraged. And even to long is where one can start. And of course, when you long, you are inviting suffering. And so it's not, so beware. And that longing can get to a point where nothing can satisfy you except to be with Baba and to be in his presence and his love. There isn't anything in this world that can really make you happy except Baba's love.
What kind of suffering were you talking about?
The suffering of longing.
Okay.
I don't know if that's clear.
Yeah.
The suffering of longing can create an energy, because it creates, in the discourses, what Baba calls divine desperation. You have to become desperate. And in that desperateness, you're willing to let go of the barriers and cross over, the ghazal, cross over the limits of your cross over your limitations. And then he reveals himself. I can't quote that quote, but are you familiar with that? When longing crosses its limits to your eyes, he will be revealed. And it goes on. We have to live that in our daily life while we're being normal persons. And it isn't easy. But I'd rather do that than not. And so we're asking for it when we come to Baba.
Literacy.
Yes.
I'm sorry, were you finished?
No, just go ahead.
Before that, before you started to experience the longing, did you experience the disgust with the world that Baba talks about and God speaks?
I think I was born with that.
Can you repeat that, please?
I just feel like... All
right, I'll try to. No, the answer to the
question. Oh, when he was asking about the disgust of the world, and I said, I think I was born with it. I think something from my past lives carried over, and it was always there with me. It was always haunting me. I mean, it wasn't a big problem, but it was there. So I think that made it easier for me to enter into longing. And it made it easier perhaps for me to be willing to take whatever comes for the sake of God.
I think he says that the longing is his grace. It's a gift from him.
Yes, I think so. But to be willing to long and to want to long seems to be part of it. I mean, it's not like, oh, I'm going to sit back and wait for his grace to come. We have to make an active commitment before anything's going to happen. Well, I shouldn't say that as a rule, because a lot of things happen to people. But for me, that's how it worked out.
But all the while, you're still the seeker. And that,
yes.
And that gets you through the disgust to the point of,
yes,
receiving his grace.
Yes. Yes. You really know where you're at, in the sense that you know you want God. You know longing is giving an actual energy force to wield the sword that will cut through all the muck of the self. And for once in your life, you're willing and have the strength and the courage to do it for the sake of love. It's following Baba is not for the faint-hearted. And I think he gives us the courage to do it. He gives us everything. He is the one who's doing it.
But getting through that first part is a real struggle.
It is. It really is. We hassle it, we thrash through it, we struggle with it, and we have days and not days, and we work with it. But in the end, he's the one that's doing it with us. That reminds me of a story in 1952 in Mrs. Deuce's apartment, where Baba was giving interviews in New York City shortly after his accident. And it was sweltering hot 3 days, just like today in New York City, up in her penthouse. And Baba was stripped to the waist in that room, giving interviews all day long with his hot cast on his leg, a tub of ice there with a fan blowing behind the ice. Our Shaw family was asked to be on hand all those days, and we were assigned various duties. My mother was asked to greet people and ask them to read this chart that was up on a stand near the interview room. And this chart said that saying that's quoted. I can't really quote it, but it's the one where Baba says, "I am approachable to all. Through all isms and no isms, too rich and poor, saint and sinner, etc." You're probably familiar with that. So that was there. Baba made a strong point about that, about his approachability to all, and I feel that's very significant. But to get back to where I was leading to, my duty was to be upstairs and answer the telephone. And I think maybe I answered the phone once, and the rest of the time someone else answered it. And Baba had me up there for another purpose, and that was that throughout that whole day, I was wrestling with myself. And it's like we build a structure.